The attributes and deeds of the Morning Star were not invented by the peoples of the world. This star shattered mountains, shook the globe with such a violence that it looked as if the heavens were shaking, was a storm, a cloud, a fire, a heavenly dragon, a torch, and a blazing star, and it rained naphtha on the earth. Assurbanipal speaks of Ishtar Venus, who is clothed with fire and bears aloft a crown of awful splendor, and who rained fire over Arabia. It has been shown previously that the comet of the days of the Exodus rained naphtha over Arabia. In the attributes and in the deeds ascribed to the planet Venus, Isis, Ishtar, Athen, we recognize the attributes and deeds of the comet described in the earlier sections of this book. The sacred cow. The comet Venus, of which it is said that horns grew out of her head, or Astarte of the horns, Venus cornuta, looked like the head of a horned animal, and since it moved the earth out of its place, like a bull with its horns, the planet Venus was pictured as a bull. The worship of a bullock was introduced by Aaron at the foot of Mount Sinai. The cult of Apis originated in Egypt in the days of the Hyksos, after the end of the Middle Kingdom, one shortly after the Exodus. Apis, or the sacred bull, was very much venerated in Egypt. When a sacred bull died, its body was mummified and placed in a sarcophagus with royal honors, and memorial services were held. All the coffins and everything excellent and profitable for this august god, the bull Apis, were prepared by the pharaoh, when this god was conducted in peace to the necropolis, to let him assume his place in his temple. The worship of a cow or bull was widespread in Minoan Crete and in Mycenaean Greece, for golden images of this animal with large horns were found in excavations. Isis, the planet Venus, was represented as a human figure with two horns, like Astarte, Ishtar, of the horns, and sometimes it was fashioned in the likeness of a cow. In time, Ishtar changed from male to female, and in many places worship of the bull changed to worship of the cow. The main reason for this seems to have been the fall of manna, which turned the rivers into streams of honey and milk. A horn planet that produced milk most closely resembled a cow. In the hymns of the Ayurveda, in which the ambrosia that falls from the sky is glorified, the god is exalted as the great cow which drips with streams of milk and as a bull that lit thy fire upon earth and heaven. A passage of the Ramayana about the celestial cow says, "Honey she gave, and roasted grain, and curled milk, and soup in lakes with sugared milk," which is the Hindu version of rivers of milk and honey. The celestial cow, or the heavenly Sarabi, the fragrant, was the daughter of the Creator. She sprung from his mouth, at the same time nectar and excellent perfume was spread, according to the Indian epic. 6. This description of the birth of the daughter from the mouth of the Creator is a Hindu parallel of Athens springing from the head of Zeus. Fragrance and nectar are mentioned in connection with the birth of the celestial cow, a combination that can be understood if we recall what we learned in the sections Ambrosia and Birth of the Planet Venus. Down to the present day, the Brahmins worship the cow. Cows are regarded as daughters of the heavenly cow. In India, as in other places, the worship of cows began in some period of recorded history. We find in early Hindu literature sufficient information to establish the thesis that cows were once victimized at sacrifices and used at times as articles of food. Then came the change. Cows became sacred animals, and ever since the religious law has forbidden the use of their meat for food. The Atharvaveda repeatedly deprecates cow killing as the most heinous of crimes. All that kill, eat or permit the slaughter of cows rot in hell for as many years as there are hairs on the body of the cow slain. A capital punishment was prescribed for those who either stole, hurt, or killed a cow. Whoever hurts or causes another to hurt, or steals or causes another to steal, a cow, should be slain. Even cow's urine and dung are sacred to the Brahmins. All its excreta are hallowed. Not a particle ought to be thrown away as impure. On the contrary, the water it ejects ought to be preserved as the best of holy waters. Any spot which a cow has condescended to honor with the sacred deposit of her excrement is forever afterwards consecrated ground. Sprinkled on a sinner, it converts him into a saint. The bull is sacred to Shiva, the god of destruction in the Hindu trinity. the consecration of the bulls and letting them loose as privileged beings to roam at their will and draw respect from all people is to be noted with particular interest. The freedom and privileges of the Brahman bull are inviolate. Even when it is destructive, the bull must not be restrained. These quotations show the Apis cult preserved until our times. The celestial cow that gored the earth with its horns and turned rivers and lakes into honey and milk is still revered in the common cow and bull by hundreds of millions of the people of India. Baalzebub, Beelzebub. The beautiful morning star was related to Ahriman, Seth, Lucifer, name equivalents of Satan. It was also bound of the Canaanites and of the northern kingdom of the ten tribes, the god hated by the biblical prophets, also Beelzebub or Baalzebub, or Baal of the fly. In the Pahlavi text of the Iranian book, the Bundahes, describing the catastrophes caused by celestial bodies, it is written that at the close of one of the world ages the evil spirit, Ahriman, went toward the luminaries. He stood upon one third of the inside of the sky, and he sprang, like a snake, out of the sky down to the earth. It was the day of the vernal equinox. He rushed in at noon, and the sky was shattered and frightened. Like a fly, he rushed out upon the whole creation, and he injured the world and made it dark at midday as though it were in dark night. And noxious creatures were diffused by him over the earth, biting and venomous, such as the snake, scorpion, frog, and lizard, so that not so much as the point of a needle remained free from noxious creatures. Then the Bundahes proceeds, the planets, with many demons, comets, dashed against the celestial sphere, and they mixed the constellations, and the whole creation was as disfigured as though fire disfigured every place and smoke arose over it. Similar plague of vermin is described in the scriptures, in Exodus, chapters 8-10, and also in Psalm 78 where it is told that there were sent divers sorts of flies among them, the people of Egypt, which devoured them, and frogs, which destroyed them. Their labor was given to the caterpillar and the locust. The dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And there came a grievous swarm of flies into all the land of Egypt. Three the second, third, fourth, and eighth plagues were caused by vermin. The plague of Irov, swarms of flies of the King James Version, is translated in the Septuagint, a stinging fly, and Philo calls it the dog fly, a ferocious insect. It is also called gnat by the rabbis. Psalm 105 narrates that Ibundahi's chap. 3, darkness was sent upon the country and locusts came, and caterpillars, and that without number, and did eat up all the herbs. Their land brought forth frogs in abundance, in the chambers of their kings, and there came divers sorts of flies, and lice in all their coasts. The Amalekites left Arabia because of ants of the smallest kind and wandered towards Canaan in Egypt at the same time that the Israelites went from Egypt toward the desert and Canaan. In the Chinese annals describing the time of Yu, from which I quoted previously, it is said that when the sun did not set for 10 days and the forests of China were destroyed by fire, multitudes of loathsome vermin were bred in the entire land. N. During their wanderings in the desert, the Israelites were plagued by serpents. A generation later, hornets preceded the Israelites under Joshua, plaguing the land of Canaan and driving entire nations from their domiciles. The inhabitants of the islands in the South Seas relate that when the clouds lay only a few feet from the ground and the sky was so close to the earth that men could not walk, myriads of dragonflies with their wings severed the clouds, confining the heavens to the earth. After the close of the Middle Kingdom, the Egyptian standard bore the emblem of a fly. When Venus sprang out of Jupiter as a comet and flew very close to the earth, it became entangled in the embrace of the earth. The internal heat developed by the earth and the scorching gases of the comet were in themselves sufficient to make the vermin of the earth propagate at a very feverish rate. Some of the plagues, like the plague of the frogs, the land brought forth frogs, or of the locusts, must be ascribed to such causes. Anyone who has experienced a Kamsan, Sirocco, an electrically charged wind blowing from the desert, knows how, during the few days that the wind blows, the ground around the villages begins to teem with vermin. The question arises here whether or not the comet Venus infested the Earth with vermin which it may have carried in its trailing atmosphere in the form of larvae together with stones and gases. It is significant that all around the world peoples have associated the planet Venus with flies. In Ekron, in the land of the Philistines, there was erected a magnificent temple to Baal Zivov, the god of the fly. In the 9th century, King Ahaziah of Jezreel, after he was injured in an accident, sent his emissaries to ask advice of this god at Ekron and not of the oracle at Jerusalem. This Baal Zivov is Beelzebub of the Gospels. Ahriman, the god of darkness who battled with Ormuzd, the god of light, is compared in the Bundakis to a fly. Of the flies that fill the earth buried in gloom it is said, his multitudes of flies scatter themselves over the world that is poisoned through and through. Ares, Mars, in the Iliad calls Athen dogfly. The gods clashed with a mighty din, and the wide earth rang, and round about great heaven pealed as with a trumpet. And Ares spoke to Athen, wherefore now again, thou dogfly, art making gods to clash with gods in strife. The people of Bororo in central Brazil call the planet Venus the sandfly, an appellation similar to that which Homer used for Athen. The Bantu tribes of central Africa relate that the sandfly brought fire from the sky, which appears to be a reference to the Promethean role of Beelzebub, the planet Venus. The Zendavesta, describing the Battle of Tistria, the leader of a change in atmospheric conditions can cause galloping germination among insects. The stars against the planets, Darmisteta, refers to worm stars that fly between the earth and heaven, and that supposedly signify the meteorites. 15 Possibly it is a reference to their infesting property. This idea of contaminating comets is found in a belief of the Mexicans described by Sahagun. The Mexicans called the comet Citlalinpopoca, which means a smoking star. These natives called the tail of such a star Citlalinlamina, exhalation of the comet, or, literally, the star shoots a dart. They believed that when such a dart fell on a living organism, a hare, a rabbit, or any other animal, worms suddenly formed in the wound and made the animal unfit to serve as food. It was for this reason that they took great care to cover themselves during the night so as to protect themselves from this inflaming emanation. The Mexicans thus thought that larvae from the emanation of the comet fell on all living things. As I have already mentioned, they called Venus a smoking star. Sahagun says also that at the rising of the morning star, the Mexicans used to shut the chimneys and other apertures in order to prevent mishap from penetrating into the house together with the light of the star. The persistence with which the planet Venus is associated with a fly in the traditions of the peoples of both hemispheres, also the emblems carried by the Egyptian priests and the temple services conducted in honor of the planet god of the fly, create the impression that the flies in the tail of Venus were not merely the earthly brood, swarming in heat like other vermin, but guests from another planet. The old question, whether there is life on other planets, has been debated time and again without much progress. Atmospheric and thermal conditions are so different on other planets that it seems incredible that the same forms of life exist there as on the Earth. On Zendavesta, the other hand, it is wrong to conclude that there is no life on them at all. Modern biologists toy with the idea that microorganisms arrive on the Earth from interstellar spaces, carried by the pressure of light. Hence, the idea of the arrival of living organisms from interplanetary spaces is not new. Whether there is truth in this supposition of larval contamination of the Earth is anyone's guess. The ability of many small insects and their larvae to endure great cold and heat and to live in an atmosphere devoid of oxygen renders not entirely improbable the hypothesis that Venus, and also Jupiter, from which Venus sprang, may be populated by vermin. Venus in the folklore of the Indians. Primitive peoples often are bound by inflexible customs and beliefs that date back hundreds of generations. The traditions of many primitive races speak of a lower sky in the past, a larger sun, a swifter movement of the sun across the firmament, a shorter day that became longer after the sun was arrested on its path. World conflagration is a frequent motif in folklore. According to the Indians of the Pacific coast of North America, the shooting star and the fire drill set the world aflame. In the burning world one could see nothing but waves of flames. Rocks were burning, the ground was burning, everything was burning. Great rolls and piles of smoke were rising, fire flew up toward the sky in flames, in great sparks and brands. The great fire was blazing, roaring all over the earth, burning rocks, earth, trees, people, burning everything. Water rushed in. It rushed in like a crowd of rivers, covered the earth, and put out the fire as it rolled on toward the south. Water rose mountain high. A celestial monster flew with a whistle in his mouth. As he moved forward, he blew it with all his might, and made a terrible noise. He came flowing and blowing. He looked like an enormous bat with wings spread. His feathers waved up and down, and grew till they could touch the sky on both sides. The shooting star that made the earth into a sea of flames, the terrible noise, the water that rose mountain high, and the appearance of a monster in the sky, like Typhon or a dragon, all these elements were not brought together in this Indian narrative by sheer invention, they belong together. The Wichita, an Indian tribe of Oklahoma, tell the following story of the deluge and the repeopling of the earth. Two, there came to the people some signs, which showed that there was something in the north that looked like clouds, and the fowl of the air came, and the animals of the plains and woods were seen. All of this indicated that something was to happen. The clouds that were seen in the north were a deluge. The deluge was all over the face of the earth. The water monsters succumbed. Only four giants remained, but they fell, too, each on his face. The one in the south, as he was falling, said that the direction he fell should be called south. The other giant said that the direction in which he was falling should be called west, where the sun goes. The third fell and named the direction of his fall north, the last called his direction east, where the sun rises. Only a few men survived. The wind also survived on the face of the earth, everything else was destroyed. A child was born to a woman, from the wind, a dream girl. The girl grew rapidly. A boy child was born to her. He told his people that he would go in the direction of the east, and he was to become the morning star. This tale sounds like an incoherent story, but let us note its various elements: something in the north that looked like clouds which made people and animals huddle together in apprehension of an approaching catastrophe, wild beasts emerging from the forests and coming to human abodes, an engulfing tide that destroyed everything, even the monster animals, the determination of the new four quarters of the horizon, a generation later the birth of the morning star. This combination of elements cannot be accidental, all these together, and then exert their whole strength in lifting the sky. In accordance with this, the people equipped themselves with poles, braced them against the sky, and then all shouted Yeo! In unison, under their combined efforts the sky rose a little. Again the people shouted Yeo! And lifted the heavy weight. They repeated this until the sky was sufficiently high. Shelton says that the word Yeo is used today when some heavy object like a large canoe is being lifted. It is easy to recognize the origin of this legend. Clouds of dust and gases enveloped the earth for a long time. It seemed that the sky had descended low. The earth groaned repeatedly because of the severe twisting and dislocation it had experienced. Only slowly and gradually did the clouds lift themselves from the ground. The clouds that enveloped the Israelites in the desert, the trumpet-like sounds that they heard at Mount Sinai, and the gradual lifting of the clouds in the years of the shadow of death are the same elements that we find in this Indian legend. Because the same elements can be recognized in very different settings, we can affirm that there was no borrowing from one people by another. A common experience created the stories, so dissimilar at first, and so much alike on second thought. The story of the end of the world, as related by the Pawnee Indians, has an important content. It was written down from the mouth of an old Indian. We are told by the old people that the morning star ruled over all the minor gods in the heavens. The old people told us that the morning star said that when the time came for the world to end, the moon would turn red. That when the moon should turn red, the people would know that the world was coming to an end. The morning star said further that in the beginning of all things they placed the north star in the north, so that it should not move. The Morning Star also said that in the beginning of all things they gave power to the South Star for it to move up close, once in a while, to look at the North Star to see if it was still standing in the north. If it was still standing there, it was to move back to its place. When the time approached for the world to end, the South Star would come higher. The North Star would then disappear and move away, and the South Star would take possession of the earth and of the people. The old people knew also that when the world was to come to an end, there were to be many signs. Among the stars would be many signs. Meteors would fly through the sky. The moon would change its color once in a while. The sun would also show different colors. My grandchild, some of the signs have come to pass. The stars have fallen among the people, but the Morning Star is still good to us, for we continue to live. The command for the ending of all things will be given by the North Star, and the South Star will carry out the command. When the time comes for the ending of the world, the stars will again fall to the earth. In this narrative of the Pawnee Indians, elements are brought together which, as we know now, actually belong together. The planet Venus established the present order on the earth and placed the North and South Polar Stars in their places. The Pawnees believe that the future destruction of the world depends on the planet Venus. When the end of the world will come, the North and South Poles will change places. In the past, the South Star left its place a few times and came up higher, bringing about a shifting of the poles, but on these occasions the polar stars did not reverse their positions. The change in the color of the sun and the moon was conditioned by the presence of cometary gases between the earth and these bodies. It is referred to in the prophets of the scriptures. Stones falling from the sky belong to the same complex of phenomena. The Pawnee Indians are not versed in astronomy. For 120 generations, father has transmitted to son and grandfather to grandchild the story of the past and the signs of future destruction. The belief that the world is endangered by the planet Venus plays an important role in the ritual of the Skiddy Pawnee Indians of Nebraska. Next in rank to Tirawa, Jupiter, stands the Morning Star. Tirawa gave most of his power to the Morning Star. Through her four assistants, wind, cloud, lightning, and thunder, she transmitted the mandates of Tirawa to the people upon earth. Next in rank to the Morning Star were the gods of four world quarters, who stood in the northeast, southeast, southwest, and northwest and supported the heavens. Next in rank was the North Star. Below these in turn were the sun and moon. The greater part of the heavenly gods were identified with stars. The sacred bundle of each village was believed to have been given to its ancestors by one of these heavenly beings. The ceremony of sacrifice to the Morning Star is the main ritual of the Pawnee Indians. It is a dramatization of the acts performed by the Morning Star. A human offering was sacrificed when Venus appeared especially bright, or in years when there was a comet in the sky. The act of appeasing Venus when a comet was seen in the sky takes on clearer meaning in the light of the present research. The sacrificial procedure took the following form. A captive girl was turned over by her captor to a man who would howl like a wolf. She was kept by the guardian until the day of the sacrifice. Her guardian then painted her whole body red and dressed her in a black skirt and robe. His face and hair were painted red, and a fan-shaped headdress of 12 eagle feathers was attached to his hair. This was the costume in which the Morning Star usually appeared in visions. The scaffold was erected between four poles that pointed to the four quarters: northeast, southeast, southwest, northwest. A few words were pronounced about the darkness that threatened to endure forever, and in the name of the Morning Star a command was addressed to the poles to keep upright so that you will always hold up the heavens. The chief priest then painted the right half of her body red and the left half black. A headdress of 12 black-tipped eagle feathers, arranged like a fan, was fastened on her head. At the moment the Morning Star appeared, two men came forward bearing firebrands. The breast of the girl was cut open and the heart taken out, and the guardian thrust his hand into the thoracic cavity and painted his face with the blood. The people around shot arrows into the body of the victim. Boys too young to draw a bow were helped by their fathers or mothers. Four bundles were laid northeast, northwest, southeast, and southwest of the scaffold and were ignited. There seem to have been astronomical beliefs connected with the sacrifices. These human sacrifices, as described by Dorsey, were executed by the Indians only a few decades ago. They recall the Mexican sacrifices to the Morning Star described by the authors of the 16th century. The meaning of these ceremonies and their relation to the planet Venus, especially in the years of a comet. The references to the cardinal points and to prolonged darkness, the anxiety that the sky should not fall, and even such details as the black and red colors so important in the ceremonies, become understandable now that we know the role Venus played in world upheavals. Chapter 10, The Synodical Year of Venus. The planet Venus, at the present time, revolves around the Sun in 288 days, which is the sidereal year of the planet. However, seen from the Earth, which revolves around the Sun on a larger orbit and at a lower speed, Venus returns to the same position with respect to the Earth after 584 days, which is its synodical year. It rises before the Sun, earlier every day for 71 days, until it reaches the western elongation or its westernmost point away from the rising Sun. Each morning thereafter the Morning Star rises lower and lower and for 221 days approaches the superior conjunction. About a month before the end of this period, it is eclipsed by the rays of the Sun, and for over 60 days it is not seen because of the Sun's rays, it is behind the Sun or in superior conjunction. Then it appears for a moment after the setting Sun, being now the evening star and east of the western Sun. For 221 nights it retreats from the middle point of the superior conjunction, and beginning with the evening on which it first appears as an evening star, each night it appears farther from the setting Sun until it reaches the eastern elongation. Then for 71 nights it approaches the Sun. Finally it enters the inferior conjunction, when it is between the Earth and the Sun. It is usually invisible for 1 or 2 days, and thereafter appears west of the rising Sun and is again the morning star. These movements of Venus and their exact duration have been known to the people of the Orient and the Occident for over 2,000 years. Actually, a Venus year, which follows the synodical revolution of Venus, was employed in calendars of the Old and New World alike. 5 synodical years of Venus equal 2,919.6 days, whereas 8 years of 365 days equal 2,920 days, and 8 Julian years of 365/4 days equal 2,922 days. In other words, in 4 years there is a difference of approximately 1 day between the Venus and the Julian calendars. As I shall show in more detail in my reconstruction of ancient history, the Egyptians of the second part of the first pre-Christian millennium observed the Venus year. A decree published in Egyptian and in Greek by the conclave of priests which took place in Canopus in the reign of Ptolemy III, Euergetes, in -239 was intended to reform the calendar according to the present arrangement of the world and an amendment of the faults of the heaven, replacing the year regulated by the rising of the star Isis, and Pliny says that Isis is the planet Venus X, with a year regulated by the rising of the fixed star Cephus, Sirius. This would make a difference of 1 day in 4 years, so that, as the decree says, the festivals of the winter should not arrive in the summer because of the change of a day every 4 years in the rising of the star Isis. The reform intended by the Canopus decree did not take root because the people and the conservatives among the priests kept faith with Venus and observed the new year and other festivals on the days regulated by it. As a matter of fact, we know that the Ptolemaic pharaohs were obliged to swear in the temple of Isis, Venus, that they would not reform the calendar, nor add a day every 4 years. Julius Caesar actually followed the Canopus decree by fixing a calendar of 365/4 days. In -26 Augustus introduced the Julian year in Alexandria, but the Egyptians outside Alexandria still continued to observe a Venus year of 365 days, and Claudius Ptolemy, the Alexandrian astronomer of the second Christian century, wrote in his Almagest, 8 Egyptian years without a sensible error equal 5 circlings of Venus. as this period of 8 years can be divided into, each part being equal to 2.5 synodical periods, the dividing point being alternately at a heliacal, simultaneous with the sun, rising or setting of Venus. The Egyptians of the second half of the last millennium before the present era observed a 4-year cycle. This is the meaning of Horoplo's information that the Egyptian year is equal to 4 years. In like manner, the Greeks counted by 4-year cycles dedicated to Athens. The Olympic Games took place every 4th year, in the beginning, every 8th year, and time was reckoned by the Olympiads. The Olympic Games were started in the 8th century.